Today's KPR Presents was originally broadcast on March 19, 2017. Sports, Race, and America. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, one of the nation's leading authorities on the issue of race and athletics. Dr. Harry Edwards has worked with Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the NFL on diversity issues. Dr. Edwards was the keynote speaker at the University of Kansas third annual symposium, The Power of Sport, February 2, 2017, at the University of Kansas Memorial Union.
Throughout the history of black sports involvement in America, four factors have been critically germane in framing and determining the trajectory of developments at the interface of sport, race, and society. The first is what I termed in 1971 in my dissertation, the first principle of the sociology of sport, that sport inevitably recapitulates the character, structure, and dynamics of human and institutional relationships within and between societies, and the ideological and political sentiments rationalizing and justifying those relationships. You can't have a racist society and a non-racist sports institution any more than you can have a chicken lay a duck egg. It's just impossible. And so from the outset, because sport was framed by political developments, from slavery through Plessy versus Ferguson, Jim Crow, segregation, and so forth, sport inevitably became political. But why should we care about what athletes think, even if sport is political? This is the second factor that I derive, and it comes from none other than Albert Einstein. In 1939, Einstein asserted, "Objective knowledge provides us with powerful instruments for achieving certain ends, but the ultimate goal itself and the longing to reach it must come from another source. Since they cannot be justified merely by reason, there is no logical reason why somebody would want to be the greatest athlete. I mean, they'd be perfectly fine sitting at home doing what everybody else does. But there's something that drives them to be a great athlete, to realize that capability. And the same with regard to science. What drives a person to want to be a doctor? Well, I want to serve people. Well, why do you want to serve people? Because you've seen other people serving people, because you've seen other great athletes. Einstein goes on, therefore, to stipulate that this longing to reach these goals exists as powerful traditions which act upon the conduct and aspirations and judgments of the individual. They are there, these goals, and the reasoning urging us into their achievement as something living. They come into being not through reason or revelation, but through the medium of powerful personalities. And of course, there are no more powerful personalities and models in society today than athletes. And black athletes have a particular role in that regard because we're so limited in terms of role models and inspiring personalities in so many other dimensions of American life. Black athletes, or athletes in society more generally, therefore, subscribe to and conform to this notion that Albert Einstein talked about in 1939. The third factor framing and determining the trajectory of developments at the interface of race, sport, and society in America is, of course, the enduring yet ever-evolving problem of white supremacy and racism in American society. This is as current and lived today as the experience and adulation that the black athlete gets. The black athlete lives with this every day, as does all minority people. I've always cringed when I see these historians say America's original sin was slavery. That's nonsense. How can intelligent people make a statement like that? Slavery was based on white supremacy. White supremacy was evident from the first time a European came to this shore. went back to Europe and said, we discovered America and there were people standing on the shore watching us get off the boat. What they were saying was, those people didn't matter. They were part of the fauna and flowers and with the squirrels and the wolves and the bears. Why? Because they are not European. They are not white. Slavery was based on white supremacy. White supremacy is the original sin, and unlike slavery, we can't say we've put it behind us. White supremacy is alive and as sick as ever in American society today, and I can prove it. Stick with me here. It was Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois who stated in 1904 that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. The problem of the 20th century has remained largely unresolved. To the extent that any of it has been resolved, it has been only piecemeal, issue by issue, rather than being cut out, root, branch, and all. In fact, it has metastasized into the problem of the 21st century, which is not just race, but because of mobility and the social media in particular, the problem of the 21st century is diversity in all of its complexity and competing interests. And it is this situation of diversity that is contributing today to the framing and development of issues at the interface of sport and society, and particularly when it comes to black athlete activism in sports, with super affluent black athletes standing up, or in Colin Kaepernick's case, kneeling down on behalf of what is happening in the black community. But you also have people now who are very much concerned about what's happening with immigrants. You have people who are very much concerned about what's happening with Muslims. I know Muslims who play in the NBA and who play in the NFL are saying, hey, wait a minute. They're talking about me. And don't tell anybody old Edwards told you, but the number one problem that they're going to be concerned about in the very near future is going to be the problem of what is happening to women. And women athletes are going to be caught up in it, and we'll talk about that toward the end of this talk here. And finally, there's a fourth factor, framing and setting the trajectory of developments at the interface of sport and race, and now diversity in society. And that is the media and its influence in creating images in sport and defining, particularly in this case, black athlete actions and achievements in sports, and in disseminating those images and definitions. And here today, I particularly include the internet and the social media. Taking these four things into consideration, the role of sport in society, its recapitulation of society, the influence of powerful personalities, the role of the media and so forth, we have to look back now and understand what has happened in the past to wrap our minds around what we're up against today. And here I talk about first, a first wave of black athletes who behaved politically. And this first wave was epitomized by Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, Jesse Owens, Paul Robeson, the Negro Leagues, and to some degree, historically black colleges and universities. From the turn of the 20th century up to the onset of World War II, America was a society afflicted by hardcore racial segregation, apartheid, by law and custom. Despite some desegregated locker rooms, particularly in the Northeast, the black athletes who excelled and prevailed largely received their greatest respect and their greatest opportunities and recognition in the international arena. And so Jack Johnson fought Tommy Burns, a Canadian, in Australia after having been ducked by white heavyweight champions in America and in England for literally years. It was in the international arena that Jack Johnson achieved his fame and respect. Jesse Owens achieved fame and respect. Where? In the international arena, running in the Hitler Munich 1936 Olympics. Black press had been writing since Jesse was a sophomore in high school that he was the greatest schoolboy athlete in the country. The white mainstream media didn't even pick up on Jesse Owens until he went to Ohio State and rewrote the record book during his first year. And it wasn't until he went to Munich and won 4 gold medals that he began to get the recognition globally. They loved him in Germany. They loved him in Europe. And they talk about Hitler not shaking his hand, which was a myth. Hitler quit shaking anybody's hands 2 days before Jesse Owens ever came onto the track for a practice run. If anybody refused to shake Jesse Owens' hand, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because they had an election coming up, and he did not want to have a photo op with a Negro, so he wasn't invited to the White House. It wasn't until Harry Truman became president and the next Olympiad in 48 that he brought the Tiger Bells from Tennessee State to the White House for a photo op to make up for the snub. If anybody snubbed Jesse Owens, it wasn't Adolf Hitler, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That's how thick the racism was here. It's also something else that you should understand. Jesse Owens was the first black athlete to propose a boycott of an Olympic Games. It wasn't Ole Edwards, don't let nobody tell you that. It was Jesse Owens. But the head of the American Olympic Committee, Avery Brundage, did a fact-finding tour to Germany and came back with the idea, no, Jesse and these athletes who are talking about boycotting the 36 games of Rome, minorities in Germany are just fine. This is all a mythology cooked up by the Eastern Press, the New York Times, and so forth. This man, Hitler, is all right. He's a statesman. And as a result of that, narrowly, by about 2 votes, the organizations that were part of the Olympic movement voted to go to Germany. That's how that team in 1936 ended up in Munich. Plus, the black press was against Jesse Owens, too, because they said, what are you talking about? Minorities in Germany are catching hell. We catching hell right here. So if you're not talking about boycotting over this hell, why are you talking about boycotting over that hell? You've been captured by somebody who has taken your mind away. You've lost your mind. So when he was up against both Avery Brundage, the Olympic Committee, all those voting to go to Germany, and the black press, Jesse said, okay. But he was the first athlete to pose a boycott. In point of fact, if Jesse Owens hadn't proposed the boycott in 1935, I wouldn't have proposed the boycott in 1968, even though he was one of the people they sent in to tell us, don't boycott. You won't be able to get a job when you come back. But he went over and ran and couldn't get a job when he came back. Unless John Carlos told him in 1968, what the hell are you talking about? I won't be able to get a job when I come back. I can't get a job now. And so... So that's just kind of left my notes here. That's a little bit of the history on this, though. The third athlete from that era was Joe Louis, of course. And again, it was in the international arena. He fought Max Melling and lost, which put a lot of pressure in 1936, which put a lot of pressure on Jesse Owens to do well in the 36 Olympics, because Max Melling had beat Joe Louis in 12 rounds. Joe Louis came back in 1938 again in an international arena and beat Smelling and became a big hero internationally and in black society. But there were a number of people who were killed because blacks were celebrating too much in the Deep South when Joe Louis beat Max Smelling. The fourth internationally relevant athlete was Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson was the first Walter Camp All-American, 1917-1918. Would have gone to Princeton University, except the president of Princeton University, who ultimately became a president of the United States, wouldn't allow him to enroll because Negroes weren't allowed to play football at Princeton. So he enrolled at Rutgers and became an All-American. And he parlayed his football notoriety into artistic visibility, which allowed him to showcase his voice. Now, this is a man, Paul Robeson, never even sang at the Glee Club, with the Glee Club at Rutgers. Because if you were a Negro, you didn't get to stand up there and sing with the Glee Club. You know, that was backwoods church stuff, you know. But once he became a great athlete and began to sing, people say, hey, you know what? This dude got a voice. And so he parlayed his athletics into international recognition, because where Robeson was really huge before he was big in this country, in terms of his voice and singing, he was big in Europe. He was big in England and in Spain and in Germany and so forth. So all four of these athletes in that period between the turn of the 20th century and World War II made their greatest inroads in terms of recognition, respect, stardom, opportunities in the international arena. That's even true of the Negro Leagues. They played each other here, but when they went abroad, they did these barnstorming tours in Mexico, in Panama, in Cuba, and even played white all-star teams in those areas and got tremendous applause and recognition for their baseball prowess, even though here they struggled for legitimacy, because the rationalization for segregation was these Negroes can't play organized baseball. What they do through instinct. All four of these great athletes made their greatest impact in the international arena because of abject apartheid and segregation here. The politics constrained what they were able to do in American society. And of course, every last one of those four athletes were cut down to size. Jack Johnson went to prison on some trumped up charges about taking a woman across international, across state lines for illicit purposes. Totally bogus law, bogus prosecution. Cut him down to size, defrocked him, and that was the end of his career. Jesse Owens and Joe Louis were busted on income tax. They went after them like they were going after Al Capone, income tax. Both of them were busted for income tax. And of course, Paul Robeson was declared a non-person and for the rest of his life was essentially shunned. And it got so bad that he even was shunned by black society, because to be associated with him was anathema. They even got Jackie Robinson, a second wave athlete, to come out and attack him before the United States Congress. And Jackie, to the day he died, said, that was the biggest mistake I ever made. When they came to me and said, we want you to condemn Paul Robeson, I should have told them, no way, and I don't care what the price is I have to pay for taking that stand. But he didn't. He went and testified, and the United States government used that against Paul Robeson with black people to say, see, even your hero is saying that this man is insane and wrong and un-American. All four of those athletes who made it in the international arena ultimately were chopped down to size, largely at the hands of not just of American society, but the United States government itself. Because if you were a Negro and you were not recognized here, then you were not going to be recognized anywhere and bring that status back to this country. That was the first wave of athletes, and that was the politics of the situation. The second wave of athletes were occasioned again by external forces. These had to do again with both national and international circumstances. Segregation at home during the first wave, plus Adolf Hitler. Second wave athletes in the post-World War II era were formed by the desegregation effort that came in the wake of World War II, plus the struggle between East and West, communism in its national state form and capitalism for control of a largely non-white third world. And so coming out of World War II, and World War II was largely a race war against white Aryan German superiority ideology and Japanese imperialism, blacks had gone into that war with what they call the double V goal: victory over racism abroad and victory over racism at home. So when they came back, they were disinclined to simply sit around and be satisfied with accommodating, as Booker T. Washington would have said, separate as the fingers, but like one as the hand, the racist circumstances in American society. On top of that, America was up against it. The old European structure had collapsed. Colonialism was on its way out. And America all of a sudden was in competition with the Soviet Union and Stalin and Mao Zedong in China for hearts and minds in the third world. And they were at a severe disadvantage because the Soviet Union and China consistently ran films and did broadcasts where they talked about the treatment of Negroes in American society, the treatment of Asians and brown people in American society. So America had to clean that up. And one of the ways that they did it was to begin to desegregate it, and started with Harry Truman desegregating the military by law. It didn't really take effect until the Korean War in 1952, but he started the action. The next to be desegregated was not the schools. That didn't happen until Brown versus Board of Education, Topeka, Kansas, in 1954. The next to be segregated was sports, because that was the highest image institution in American society. In 1946, Kenny Washington and Woody Strode from UCLA integrated what became the NFL, followed by Bill Willis and Marion Motley at Cleveland, at the Cleveland Browns. Earl Lloyd and Chuck Cooper in 1950 integrated the NBA, and Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby in 1946, shortly after Woody Strode and Kenny Washington integrated football, integrated Major League Baseball. Again, the external realities of struggle were political. That's what drove the dynamics, framed and fueled the effort. And just as Robeson and those athletes struggled for legitimacy, to demonstrate if we can compete against the world, why are we not competing against our own people in American society? Jackie Robinson and Woody Strode and Kenny Washington and that second wave struggled for access. That was about access to mainstream institutions. By the end of the 1950s, there had already begun to emerge, thanks to largely the civil rights movement and the gains that had been made toward desegregation, a third wave of athletes. And this third wave was epitomized most of all by the individual that I call the godfather of the third wave of athletes, Muhammad Ali. He not only violated all of the second wave rules, where you played your sport, then you shut up and went back to the community, and that was just part of the price of gaining access. You didn't talk about the racism in the locker room. You didn't talk about the inequities in the society. You didn't talk about the fact that the very people who came to see you, if you were Willie Mays playing baseball in San Francisco, would not allow you to buy a home in Pacific Heights. If you were Wilt Chamberlain playing basketball for the San Francisco Warriors, you could not buy a home in Pacific Heights. You didn't talk about that. You went back to your community, kept quiet, played the game, and kept a low profile. Ali broke all of that. He said, "I'm beautiful. I'm the greatest. I'm the prettiest man," you know, and so forth and so on. And they resented it. They started off, he's a clown, the Louisville Lip, the Kentucky clown. And then all of a sudden, Malcolm X began to talk to him, mold him, frame him. "Hey, here's what's really going on. Here's what you're dealing with." And all of a sudden, Muhammad Ali emerged out of Cassius Clay, and he wasn't so funny anymore. From that point in 1960, and when I first met him, it was an interesting thing. Julie Menendez, I was recruited as a track athlete. I just set a national junior college discus record and was playing basketball and so forth at a junior college, larger, because I didn't have the grades to get into a four-year school. But I was recruited by San Jose State, and in the summer of 1964, and that was the Rome Olympics coming up. The boxing coach, boxing was a collegiate sport at that time. The boxing coach was Julie Menendez, who was the boxing coach at San Jose State. He was also from East St. Louis, which is where I was from, which is why I went to San Jose State to begin with. But when I got to campus on a visit, he said, "I want you to come in and meet some of the young boxers." Well, Ali was born in January of 1942. I was born in November of 1942. So we were about the same age. And so Julie wanted me to meet him and say, this is a kid about your same age, but he's a heck of a boxer. He said, but be careful because I can't shut him up. I can't stop him from talking. And so when I met Cassius Clay, lo and behold, my first impression of him was that he was nuts, you know, because I had never seen anybody over the years, there was no way I would know that our lives would intertwine the way they have over the years, the way they did over the years. But he broke all of the rules. He was loud. He was bodacious. He was braggadocious. And, you know, I mean, he was up in people's face. And whenever he was, you couldn't stop him. You couldn't shut him up. And I said, man, this dude is insane. I thought he was literally insane. Over the years, of course, it turns out that he was simply a brilliantly beautiful, gifted athlete who understood, who saw the world differently. And before it was over, the last four decades of the 20th century, he stood astride the world, the most recognizable face in the world, stood astride the world of athletics and social issues like a colossus. I mean, he dwarfed all of the rest of us, and he framed up the struggles that came afterwards. He made it possible for a Smith and Carlos to step forward, for Arthur Ashe to be concerned about what's happening in South Africa, for Bill Russell and Jim Brown to be something other than that superstar athletes who were disgruntled and angry because of the racism that they dealt with. He framed all of that up. He led the way that opened doors for the rest of us to see the world more clearly. That struggle for access led into toward the end of that third wave, the struggle for dignity and respect. And so just as Jackie Robinson was our Gandhi, we didn't know anything about Gandhi. Most of us couldn't spell his name. But Jackie Robinson had us involved in nonviolent direct action 10 years before Dr. King ever came on the scene. Because when you went out to the stadium, you're in the stadium, you could hear the N-bombs being dropped on Jackie. You saw the black cats being thrown on the field. You heard all of the slurs and people sliding in the second with their spikes up trying to hurt Jackie. But we were told, when you go to the stadium, here's the way you act. You don't react. You simply take it, turn the other cheek. Turn the other cheek. This is what Jackie Robinson did for 10 years. By the time 1956 came around, Jackie Robinson was ready to retire. And Dr. King was just coming on the scene with the Montgomery bus boycott effort. And we had already been schooled in nonviolent direct action. So when he started talking about nonviolent direct action, we knew exactly what he was talking about. Thanks to sports, there's a direct line of ascent between Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby in that second wave fighting for access, that third wave coming along and fighting for dignity and respect, Ali, Bill Russell, Carlos Smith, Jim Brown, Arthur Ashe, Kurt Flood said, I'm an $80,000 a year slave. It wasn't about the money, it was about dignity and respect. To Tony Dungy hoisting the Lombardi Trophy in the wake of Bill Russell being named the first black head professional coach out of dignity and respect, and Obama being elected to the White House. There's a direct line of ascent there. In point of fact, Obama never would have been elected to the White House if it hadn't been for Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali not only made it possible to have somebody with a strange sounding name accepted, but to have that name embraced. You didn't have to be named George Washington, Lincoln, Kennedy, Johnson to be accepted in the mainstream. You could be named, you could have a funny name like Barack Hussein Obama and be elected to the presidency not once but twice. That goes back to the struggle that Ali put on and what he did in the ring when he would just pound people. What's my name, sucker? Tell me, what is my name? I mean, he would just beat them into the ground until finally people say, well, you know, your name Muhammad Ali, you know? And so all of that is in sports. It's political, but it's all in sports. So now we are in a fourth wave. We're in a fourth wave of athletic activism. This is a wave of activism where Black athletes are ultimately in pursuit of power. They have the money, they're walking corporations. It's to the point that, believe me, if Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson decided they were gonna go to Jerry Brown in the governor's office and say, Jerry, we got some problems in Oakland we want you to address. Do you think Jerry gonna tell them to get lost? No. Why? Because that's about $150 million walking through the door. Not to speak of the fact that if they go around the state and say, hey, not just Jerry, but anybody associated with Jerry, forget about them being the governor, it's over. They're done. They wield that type of power as powerful personalities that Einstein talked about in 1939. This fourth wave of black athletes ultimately are in pursuit of power. They are often walking corporations, as I stated, and they have an ability to leverage that power in ways that back in 1968 we could have never dreamed of. Black athletes in the NBA compelled the removal of an owner. Unbelievable. Don Sterling got him out, walked in and said, hey, we're not going to play against the Clippers until this guy's gone. You know what? 2 months later, he was gone. Athletes at the University of Missouri, athletes, students been picketing and demonstrating and sitting in for 2 years. All of a sudden, athletes sent out a tweet with their picture, we back the students, and we want the president gone. In 3 days, not just the president, but the chancellor were gone. And at the end of the year, the coach was gone. This is power. Athletes recognize that. LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Carmelo Anthony, and Chris Paul go to ESPN and say, we want some time, and we don't just want time doing at the halftime of a game. We want time doing your awards program with the ESPYs because we got something to say. And you know what ESPN said? How much time you gonna need? I mean, what? No. Well, geez, now what? We just can't just. We have sponsors. How much time you gonna need? They said we'll let you know, and they stood up and made their statement. Colin Kaepernick, derided and disparaged in the mainstream media up to and including seeking out and broadcasting footage of fans burning his jersey. But the athletes in the league and a great number of citizens in the country made that same jersey the number one selling jersey in the NFL last year, outpacing Tom Brady, Drew Brees, and everybody else, because he had the power to leverage that message that he had. And on top of it, at the end of the year, the athletes in the locker room at the 49ers, who everybody said, well, he split the locker room. He's got them fighting each other. Got some on one side and some on the other. No. At the end of the year, they voted him the Lynn Eshmont Award, which is the highest award that an athlete can achieve. It's voted by his teammates for the athlete that showed courage and judgment and spirit commensurate with that of Lynn Eshmont, who was on the first 49er team and died of a horrific disease but never stopped fighting. He was voted the Lynn Eshmont Award. The media gets it wrong, because they're not even looking in the right direction most of the time, and that is a serious issue, as we'll see. So now the struggle is for power. My main point in all of this is that what we see today is neither unique nor merely a mimicking of the 1960s. Continuing waves of black athlete activism are both inevitable and rationally comprehensible. It is only the who, the when, the where, the what, and so forth that remains unpredictable. And now we are in one of those eras, as I stated, which may be the most tumultuous since the Civil Rights Movement, perhaps even since the collapse of Reconstruction. In the age of Trump, all of this is going to intensify. We are a divided society, and our electoral politics do not resolve those divisions as has been the case in the past, they harden the divisions. The barricades become higher. The fences become more impenetrable. The exit celebrations of the Obama administration often seemed and felt like victory laps around a cemetery, with open graves with pre-carved headstones reading such things as "Here lies Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood. Here lies the Affordable Care Act. Here lies trade, environmental, and nuclear disarmament agreements. Here lies the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. Here lies equal pay for women." And the struggle over these issues will inevitably encompass sports. It is absolutely unavoidable. It's absolutely unavoidable. Just as surely as the situation at the University of Missouri on the campus eventually drugged the football team into it, these demonstrations that have already broken out on campuses around this country are going to involve the football and basketball players and so forth. Why? Because these athletes and these revenue-producing sports have power. And if they come on the campuses looking for the undocumented immigrants or the Muslims, or if women's sports are in trouble, they're going to call on these athletes. And these athletes have more power, not just in terms of the leverage they have, but in terms of their messaging than ever before. In 1968, I'd make 100 telephone calls, hope that 50 people would call me back, hope that I would be there to answer the phone 20 times, and hope that five of them, once they found out what I wanted, wouldn't just slam the phone down. Now an athlete comes up with something and he hits the one single most powerful, dangerous, and explosive four-letter word in human history, S-E-N-D, and it goes out to millions of people. Everybody he sends it to, sends it to somebody. Next thing you know, he's getting an email from China. This is the power that they have along with their status. You look at the money that comes out of the national football, amateur football championship, NC2A. Tens of millions of dollars paid to two schools and conferences for one game. Look at the Final Four and the money that comes out of it. These athletes have power. And as I told somebody earlier, a lot of them are not aware of that power yet. But as this thing evolves and opens up, they will become aware of it, because even Rip Van Winkle eventually woke up. And so once this happens, we've got to manage what we can neither eliminate nor avoid. We've got to figure out how we're going to manage it. These athletes today are subject to more pressure and to utilize and leverage that power than ever before. As the civil rights movement is attacked and you get demonstrations on campuses, as you begin to get into areas of religious freedom and you get demonstrations on campuses, these people are going to go to these athletes and say, "You need to take a stand. You need to speak up." And some are going to. They may not speak up on your campus, but the school you play, they speak up. And so all of a sudden, whether it's on your campus, whether there's a boycott, it's on the campus of the school that you play at, hey, you know what? That money's gone. It's over. And then there are other areas that we just need to be aware of. People forget that in 1972, you had Title IX of the Civil Rights Movement invoked so that women would get parity in terms of collegiate athletics. A lot of women who've come in here since 1972 came as a consequence of Title IX. Up until 1972, there were 26 institutions that gave scholarships to women in athletics, most of them black. After 1972 and Title IX, it has now burgeoned up to over 540 schools give scholarships to women. But what people forget is that in 1972, there was also Roe v. Wade. And so there were medical services and access to pills and morning after and everything else that they needed in order to, that they chose when they would start a family, when they would have a baby, when they would become pregnant. I'm a pre-1972 athlete. And I know how many students on campus, there were no women athletes, how many students on campus went home and came back the next year, and their mama had a little brother that she had to take care of. Go back and look at the records of how many women athletes before 1972 had children and ran in the 1960 Olympics, the 1964 Olympics, and so forth. 1972 was what gave these institutions the assurance, we can give this young lady a scholarship in September, and she's going to be around to run in the NC2As in June. We can give this young lady a scholarship in September, and she's going to be around to play in the NC2A basketball tournament in March. Well, now you got situations such as in Texas, quite certain in other states, where they had 44 women's clinics, including some of them on campuses. Now they have 14, and only four of those have admission privileges at a hospital, which means that they can't do anything in terms of morning after pills or abortions. All the rest of them are out in the cold, only those four. I was down in Texas and was talking to a lady. She had to drive 500 miles to get morning after pills. That's your female athletic pool, not to speak of your student enrollment. So if Roe v. Wade is buried and nothing replaces it in terms of women having options, we wouldn't be in this situation if men had babies. They'd clean that one up. If we, and there are no options, then you know what you're looking at? You're looking at a return to pre-1972 women's sports. Not because of just what's happening on the campus with women athletes and so, but because of what happens in the pool before they even get offered a scholarship offer. That's the reality. And you can say, well, we're pushing abstinence. Hey, it didn't work when I was growing up. And something tells me that human nature may have changed, but it ain't changed that much. So Roe v. Wade is going to be a big issue that's going to impact in sports. And the thing that I find so challenging is that I don't see a big outcry about it. Where are the women athletes saying, hey, wait a minute. Okay, I can understand your concerns about Roe v. Wade, but what about this? I don't see that. You have a situation with the WNBA with an average salary is $39,495 a year. Top of the line, you're looking at $50,000. And so a lot of these women who have families, they're trying to maintain their homes, they're trying to maintain themselves so that they'll be around to play in the next season, they wind up playing in Europe. They wind up playing in the Middle East. So this past month, if you go back and look at the New York Times, there was a story last week about 26 women who were playing on various teams and so forth in Turkey. And after a game, they went out to this nightclub. Half a block down, a suicide bomber went in, killed 29 people, half a block from the club that they were in. It's a half a block between them and this suicide bomber. And the argument for having the WNBA is that this is not a market-driven thing. We're doing this, as David Stern said, because it's right. As long as there's an NBA, there's going to be a WNBA. This is not a market-driven thing. Well, if it's not a market-driven thing to have the league, why does it have to be a market-driven thing in terms of how much they're paid? Because the argument is, well, they don't bring in anything, so we don't have to pay them anything. If they brought in money, we would pay them money. Why not pay them a living wage so that they don't have to go abroad in the off season? Because one day we're going to add tragedy to this travesty of not paying them enough. Because all of a sudden you're going to have 15, 16, 18 of these women coming back here in boxes because they're in the wrong place playing a basketball game in what is essentially a war zone. They're doing it so that they can pay their mortgages, they can pay their bills, they can keep themselves up, they can be around and in good shape to play next season. $39,000, less than $39,500 before taxes? You're kidding me. So this is another thing that we need to speak out about in terms of women, and it should be the male athletes of the NBA who does it. Why? Because the question that was asked up here, why do you think that women don't get as much press when they speak out as men? Because we are basically a swinish, chauvinistic, male-dominated society. It's as simple. And we don't have to go, well, geez, you know, they don't do that. No. We're talking about male chauvinism. We are a male chauvinistic society. And so male athletes have to, LeBron, Steph, these athletes have to stand up and say, hey, you know what? If the market doesn't drive us keeping the league alive, then why should the market determine how much we pay the players who play there? If they can pay LeBron $27 million a year, if they can pay Kobe $31 million in his last year, if they can pay somebody else $20 million, then there's absolutely no reason why the very best players in the NBA shouldn't make $1 million a year, at least so they don't have to go overseas and put their lives on the line just in order to stay viable. And that's one that men have to speak up on. There's also the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, which are under attack already. They call it voter suppression, but all it is the elimination of the Voting Rights Act. And that is going to draw demonstrations, and these athletes are going to be called upon to stand up and make statements because they have power. You can get 2,000 students on the campus demonstrating, but if the basketball team stands up and says, yeah, and we with the students, you know what? All of a sudden people begin to listen. Why? Because there are tens of millions of dollars at stake. And with the internet, if it happens at Missouri, it will happen at UCLA and USC and Oregon and Washington, University of Kansas. It's just a matter of time, just as sure as we're standing here. So my basic message to you is this, is that this idea of separating politics and sport is ludicrous. Sport is politics, always has been framed by, fueled by, and inflamed by politics. The issue now is, how do we manage what we can neither eliminate nor avoid? That was the problem we had at the 49ers, and it ended up on my desk. And in the end, 49ers, I mean, we were 2-14, but it didn't have anything to do with Kaepernick demonstrating. It had to do with the fact that we didn't have any talent. And that wasn't my shop, thank God. That was the coach's shop, but he's gone now too. So, I mean, we had to manage that. And there are ways to manage these situations to get out, get on top of them, if not out in front of them. Okay, I'm going to stop. And I hope there are some questions if we have time. I know I've gone a little bit over.
You're listening to Dr. Harry Edwards and the Power of Sport Symposium at the University of Kansas. Coming up, Dr. Edwards takes questions from the audience. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from Stoneback Appliance, 9th and Iowa in Lawrence, locally owned and operated with over 50 years of sales and repairs. More information is at stonebackappliance.com.
Dr. Edwards, first, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Your work with the 49ers, I assume that you have been an influential advisor to Colin Kaepernick, and you were also, for what for me at 17 years old, was the defining moment in sports for me when John Carlos and Tommy Smith raised their black gloved hands at the 68 Olympics. Could you share a little bit of the conviction in those three gentlemen's hearts to take a stand knowing that Carlos and Smith probably were throwing away their careers when they stuck their hands up into the air? and that they were fighting a racist in Avery Brundage at the time, that was the head of the Olympic Committee, and then for Colin Kaepernick to do the same thing this past year. What kind of gentlemen are those three? You talked about Ollie. I'd like to know your thoughts, because you were so close to all three of them, about the conviction in their hearts.
Let me speak first about John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Carlos is out of New York, so he knew of Malcolm X. When I first went to Cornell, I did my master's thesis on the Black Muslim family and went down to New York, and I had the privilege of meeting and speaking with Malcolm for the first time I went down, and then the second time I was supposed to go down again, but he got killed that Sunday. We were snowed in Ithaca, New York, and I didn't go down, but he was killed that Sunday at the Audubon Ballroom. That was about, I met with him in August, just before he went to the Middle East on that Hajj, and I saw him one time after that, after he got back in November. He was assassinated on February 21st, 1965. I met with Dr. King on January 17th, 1968, when he endorsed the Olympic Project for Human Rights. We were supposed to get together again on April the 8th. He didn't make it. He was assassinated on April the 4th. John Carlos and Tommy Smith, we were talking about this the whole period of time because they were involved in the Olympic Project for Human Rights movement. On June the 5th, I was working with a group of students who were putting together posters and placards and everything for the presidential candidate we were all supporting because he was anti-war, Bobby Kennedy. He was in L.A. and he was supposed to come up and speak in Berkeley that next day. And the kids at San Jose State and I and a bunch of other anti-war kids were putting together placards and things because he wanted a diverse and big population, lot of placards and one thing, another waving, but he didn't make it. He was assassinated the night of June the 6th. And Smith and Carlos kind of lived through that with me. By that time, I had become hardened to the fact that, you know, this was America. The assassination of Malcolm X, who I knew, like I'm sitting here talking to you, the assassination of Dr. King, who I sat across from and talked for 2 hours about the Olympic Project for Human Rights and what we were trying to do before he came out and said, yeah, I support this as one of the last nonviolent efforts that we can make in light of what's going on in the country and the war and everything. Bobby Kennedy, who was he was anti-war, he was our candidate, he's gone. But then, you know, my 21st birthday was November 22nd, 1963. So I had become hardened to it. With Smith and Carlos, their eyes were opening wider. And so by the time the games came around and Avery Brundage and the United States Olympic Committee sent around Jesse Owens to tell them, you're gonna destroy your life, it was almost like a joke. I'm gonna destroy my life, and I'm looking at Dr. King. I'm going to destroy my life, and I'm looking at Bobby Kennedy. And I got a chance to make a statement saying that this madness has to end. So that's where Smith and Carlos were. With Colin, if I had to pick one kid of everybody that I knew at the time, every sport, who I thought would stand up and do what he did, he would be the last one. You're looking at a mixed race kid who was raised in Turlock, California, and who went to college at University of Nevada, Reno, not exactly a bastion of diversity, and was drafted by the 49ers in the second round. But over the time that he was there, like most of the athletes, hey Doc, I need to ask you about something. Can you give me a book to read? I'm interested in understanding better what this was about. Tell me about Ali. Tell me about what you knew about Malcolm X. Tell me about, And those conversations would go on and on. And it was like all of a sudden there was a breakthrough. And the only thing that mattered beyond his football was that he was true to what he knew to be true. And that was, somebody has got to stand up and say, enough is enough. This killing has to stop. This murdering of black men, women, and children in the black community has to stop. Injustice has to stop. You can't tell me land of the free and home of the brave, and I'm sitting up there looking at my TV set as a black man is shot in the back, as a black child is shot down, as a black woman is murdered, and nobody goes to jail, nobody's prosecuted. Somebody's got to stand up and say enough. Now, if it were purely the real circumstances that were driving people, you would have everybody doing it. But that's what I know, that's what I understand, that's what I grasp. But beyond that, it's like the old St. Vincent Benet poem, two ships on the same sea blown by the same wind take off in opposite directions because there's an X factor that you don't know until that action takes place. And so there's an X factor in a Tommy Smith, in a Muhammad Ali, in a Bill Russell, in a Jim Brown, in a John Carlos, in a Colin Kaepernick, in a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, in a Chris Webber, that separates them out from all of the people around them who see the same things. There's an X factor that we cannot deduct from the action that we're able to see, because it's something deep in the soul and the psyche of a person that pushes them to fight through the death threats. And Cap got a bunch of death threats. I mean, he got death threats every day. But there's something that pushes you through that. I saw it in Malcolm X, I saw it in Dr. King, I saw it in people like Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael. I saw it in Huey Newton, who was so fearless, people thought he was insane. There's an X factor that says, this is where I stand. Or as Paul Robeson put it, here I stand. So those were the things that I saw in those men. And it wasn't like I'm saying, standing back and saying, yeah, they take, I mean, between fall of 1967 and the Olympic Games, right after the Olympic Games, I mean, I got over 300 death threats myself. So I know what that's like when you come up here. If you don't break the cap on that bottle of water and you give them a lecture somewhere, you don't drink that. I wouldn't even go in the restaurant and eat, unless it was a smorgasbord or one of them all-you-can-eat places where you go in and everything laid out, because if they didn't know I was coming, they couldn't poison me. So I know what that's like. Can't go to a restaurant. Can't go to a filling station where it's just you out there pumping gas. You sit in the car and your lady gets out and pumps the gas. Because the minute you step out, here comes a crowd and you don't know what they got. And to live like that, to put up with that and still continue every Sunday during the playing of the national anthem to take a knee and say, the killing has to stop. The killing must stop. That's a special person, and there's only so much of it we can account for.
You've been listening to Dr. Harry Edwards, the keynote speaker at the 3rd Annual Power of Sport Symposium at the University of Kansas. This event was held February 2nd, 2017 at the University of Kansas Memorial Union. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.